Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the Indie Football Podcast, Rising Above the Noise. The first weekend of the season is in the books, and thus we have a jam-packed show for you today, reviewing all 10 games from a topsy-turvy few days of football. Joining me to do just that is a cast of writers, the likes of which have not been seen together since Tolstoy, Mark Twain, and R.L. Stein went out for a beer to discuss their era-defining works. Yes, say hello to Jack Pitbrook, our man about London town. Hello, Jack.
Hi, Ed.
Opposite Jack, we have young Evan Bartlett. Evan, say hello.
Hi, Ed.
And we also have indie football young buck Luke Brown in the house. Luke, say ciao.
Ciao.
And there we have someone who follows instructions. Without further ado then, the Premier League is underway. A hell of a lot of games to review. 10 of them, 31 goals, 3 red cards, 2 own goals and endless storylines. So where do we start? I think the natural place is to kick things off at Stamford Bridge, where the defending champions Chelsea were knocked off 3-2 in a thrilling game at Stamford Bridge by Burnley, of all teams. Jack Pitbrook, talk me through it.
It was an amazing result, which no one expected. But after it happened, lots of people were saying, oh, this was in fact very similar to the great Chelsea collapse in the autumn of 2015, 2 years ago, from a similar position, having won the title comfortably the previous year. But what, you know, when you watch the goals back, what was so remarkable was that the goals looked exactly like goals they conceded 2 years ago. You know, the ball would come into the box, the Chelsea defenders would basically stand still, frozen. The communication was non-existent, the marking was non-existent, and then a team that no one would expect to get a result there somehow managed to turn them over. You can't emphasise it enough. It was just like, you know, the famous Palace win under Mourinho, the famous Southampton win under Mourinho, the Swansea draw,
it was
the
sloppy,
Liverpool win.
Basically.
Yeah, it was just the complete opposite of what the manager would want them to do.
I know slightly different circumstances, but they did start slow last year before they switched formation. So, could it just be, once again, Conte's side's a little bit undercooked?
It could be, yeah. I mean, there are lots of, like, reasons for why this happened, which would suggest that it's something that they could overcome and that it's not going to be like the great 2015 catastrophe all over again. You know, we have to be fair. We don't know whether it's going to be that bad, but on the evidence that we have, it could definitely be that bad.
The obvious concern for Chelsea is their squad, which was just about deep enough last year, considering they're fighting, without European football. But they're fighting on more fronts this year. They have managed to thin their squad out, essentially. Their outfield options on the bench against Burnley were outside Alvaro Morata, who came on, got a goal and assist, and I thought looked very good, but was deemed unfit before the game. Kennedy, Musonda, Christensen, Tomori, and Scott, with Jeremy Boga in the starting lineup. Is that a champion's?
No, I mean, Chelsea have been quite effective, I think, the last 2 years in trying to run their team with a small squad, like it's, you know, sort of 17, 18 reliable first team players. But now they look so, so far from that. All it takes is a few injuries. Compare them to, for example, to the quality that City had on the bench. You know, their kind of nominal title rivals on Saturday when they had Bernardo Silva, Leroy Sané, Yaya Touré, Raheem Sterling on the bench. I mean, the gap is just night and day. And for that reason, I mean, I know, of course, Chelsea will have players to come back, although, of course, they'll be without Fabregas and Cahill when they play Tottenham at Wembley on Sunday. All of a sudden, this kind of title defence is now looking like it's on very shaky ground indeed.
It still sounds weird when you say they're playing at Wembley on Saturday. You make it sound like it's some sort of big occasion. It is just a Premier League game. After all, Luke, you're looking at that Chelsea team. They've been linked with a couple of players. We know Conte wants players. We know it's been a kind of theme of their summer that he desperately wants these players. Daniel Drinkwater is a guy that they're really after. Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain's another guy they're after. Maybe Sergi Roberto, who's trying to get a new contract at Barcelona as well. So what sort of players do you think? Do you think they need? Is it just the bench guys who can come in and be top quality starters, or do you think they are trying to actually fill out this first 11 some more?
I think their starting 11 is still very strong, and I think that obviously, you know, they did win the league last year. Antonio Conte is one of the best managers in football,
and Hazard to come back from injury.
Yeah, they've got Hazard to come back from injury. I think what must be incredibly frustrating for Chelsea fans is that the players they're being linked with aren't necessarily a better quality than the players that have left. Obviously ignoring Sergio Roberto, who's brilliant.
Yeah.
But when you look at players like Matic is the most obvious example, Chalobah, who had a really, really good game for Watford against Liverpool, even people like Atsu and people like that, those kind of fringe players, they could have come off the bench and had a good game.
Well, Atsu was good for Newcastle, I
exactly,
thought.
Yeah,
he was dangerous against Spurs. Ruben Loftus-Cheek had an excellent game for Palace in a dreadful result for them, and Chalobah was good for Watford. So that is, I guess, the problem is, why do you need to go out and spend money on Danny Drinkwater when you had someone like Chalobah in the building before? And that's just an enduring problem Chelsea have had. But I feel like we're ignoring Burnley a little bit here, Evan. They were tipped for relegation by, I think, every single person Premier League preview. They are now 7.5% of the way to Premier League survival, according to mathematics. Maths correspondent, Evan. How were Burnley?
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it, really, that, you know, once again, they've sold arguably their two best players in Michael Keane and Andre Gray, but, you know, they just carry on doing what they do. They grind out results.
Very dicey.
Very dicey, yeah. It's not, you know, the most attractive football at times, but very effective. And I think they're, you know, arguably their biggest problem will be if the manager gets taken by another club.
Well, I mean, Dyche was very keen on that Palace job.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. And it shows what a good manager can do, and it's the same with Tony Pulis. Is a guy who seems like he can always keep a team up. Do you think Dyche is kind of becoming that guy that we'll see him go to another club and be a firefighter at some point?
Yeah, I guess so. I think that's, you know, he's almost going to be a victim of his own success in that sense, that maybe someone like an Allardyce, who's always argued that he's deserved to get a bigger job, but, you know, when he keeps proving that he's going to take a team that's kind of championship, you know, lower Premier League level, then clubs at that level are going to want to take him on and want him to do the same job. Whether he's actually going to be able to break through and get a job at a big, you know, Europa League or Champions League club, then it's hard to say, isn't it? Who's going to take that gamble?
Jack, do you think there is a view of Dyche that he just has quite a low ceiling as a manager? Kind of, he, in the same way that Tony Pulis is viewed, he'll get you to 40 points, but he's not probably going to get you to 50.
Yeah, I mean, I think that probably is part of how people think about him. I think it's fair enough that people would think that, because that is the job that he's done so far. I think that I wouldn't blame the owner of a mid-table or like potential Europa League level side for thinking that, because ultimately, you know, managing for 40 points is a very different job from managing for 50 or 60 points.
Yeah.
And so I don't think it's snobbery to think that. I think it, you know, I'm not saying he couldn't do it, but I'm saying that we don't know that he could do it.
And from one title challenger downed at home to another, we look at our first Premier League newbies in Huddersfield, who triumphed 3-0 at Selhurst Park and went top for 24 hours at least, in a stunning result. Steve Mounier for the Golden Boot this season, do you think, Evan?
He could well be up there, couldn't he? There were some quotes after the game. He was talking about trying to emulate Didier Drogba, who's a big idol of his, and coming in, and that towering header that he scored in quite early on against Palace was very reminiscent of Drogba.
He scored a lot of headed goals. I think he was the second most headed goals in Ligue 1 last year. He's got 14 goals, which is one fewer than Kylian Mbappe, of course, £180 million worth of player. I think Huddersfield were slightly flattered by the scoreline from what I saw of the game, which was most of it. But this is the first Premier League team whose first goal in the division has been an own goal. That's a weird stat, but a nice one. Thanks to our friends at Opta for that. Crystal Palace, obviously the main issue is there, that this big system change, the big managerial change, a lot of change, Luke. Too much change, do you think, for the players to take on board? Or
I think when you get kind of more kind of philosophical managers, perhaps, kind of managers coming in and wanting to implement a whole sweeping tactical change, obviously that's going to take much longer for players to adjust. And let's not forget that Crystal Palace had some serious problems last season anyway. The defence was...
The
defence was just a shambles. They relied a lot on kind of their flair players, the likes of Zaha and Townsend, and obviously Benteke, to kind of bail them out a lot of the time. It will take time. I think obviously this result is a bit of a freak result. You would hope that it almost like spurs them into action. it might even make kind of the new manager kind of row back on some of his ideas. Sometimes you can come into a club and you want to change everything immediately and get to your kind of style of football, straight from game one. But you might actually need that little bit of time
You seem like you agree with that, Jack.
Yeah. Do you think the players that he has there can play the way he wants them to play?
Well, I think that's the problem. Frank de Boer has a bit of an uphill struggle from here. He came in and was pretty determined to switch to this system, which has never seemed to fit the personnel, least of all Palace's best players, Wilfried Zaha, Christian Benteke, and to an extent, I think you could say even Luka Milivojevic doesn't suit him, and he was so important down the stretch last year. De Boer has not been given the money to go out and remodel the squad to find players that do fit his system. So he's reliant on these players all adapting within 6 weeks of pre-season training starting, which is virtually impossible. I think they didn't look close to doing that. There are a lot of players that looked so uncomfortable in this shape. Scott Dan is one of those. Gave away, I think you might have seen it, the Meunier chance where Timothy Fosu-Mensah made an unbelievable recovering tackle. But Dan gave that ball away dawdling. They're supposed to be passing it out from the back. They're supposed to be playing possession football, and it's not natural to a lot of the guys that are in there.
It's quite a big switch from kind of Allardyce ball to...
It's a huge switch, and as I say, maybe they just haven't had enough time. You've got to give them time, but the fact is, if you give them time and then by October, November, you're a significant amount of points off safety, it's an issue. Joel Ward's inclusion was baffling because he was deemed too slow to play that role in the pre-season. They played Andros Townsend at right wing back for every pre-season game, and then Joel Ward came in and was targeted and pretty much embarrassed all afternoon by Huddersfield. So there's a lot to think about for Palace. Huddersfield, though, fair play. Again, 7.5% of the way to safety. David Wagner, impressive sort of coach. All those players love playing for him. And I think they might surprise a couple of people. But we'll move on from Selhurst Park to North London Friday night. Arsenal against Leicester City. The first game of the season, Arsenal looked the same old self for a bit, but then showed a bit of character to come up with that win. Jack, Olivier Giroud also reminding everyone that he's still around with a late winner off the bench.
Yeah, I mean, it's Wenger admitted after the game that Giroud could have left this summer if he wanted to. You know, there were good offers there from Marseille, Everton, Besiktas, but he's decided to stay. And I think that, I mean, I think that's quite admirable because he's it shows the kind of character Giroud is. But it also does, I mean, he does always give Arsenal that plan B. I mean, this is kind of the problem for Giroud, is that he's probably the best plan B in the Premier League, but he's not really quite good enough to be Arsenal's plan A. Like, every time that Wenger's chosen him as a plan A, he's then decided to play Welbeck up front, or Sanchez, absolutely, or buy Lacazette, because he knows that Giroud isn't really kind of sharp or quick enough to be that cutting edge. But there is, you know, there is certainly not since City sold Aidan Dzeko a few years ago, there is no one like him, you know, to throw him on in the second half, balls into the box, and he will always, always get you a goal.
It's a bit like having the best backup quarterback in the NFL. Like, he's not good enough to be the guy, but they can toss Giroud. And Giroud and Ramsey both came on, and I thought both did well. Ramsey starting the season as kind of a backup in midfield behind Elneny. How do you think his future's panning out there? It's a weird season for him.
Well, I think that Aaron Ramsey is Arsenal's best midfielder. I think that Arsenal's best football in the last 2 years was, for example, kind of remember in 2013-14, where he was absolutely brilliant before he got a muscle injury around Christmas. I think he's an incredible player. I think he had been looking a bit lost at Arsenal the last few years, because basically particularly with the arrival of Ozil and with Cazorla playing in the middle, he couldn't really play that attacking midfield role that he likes to play, because he's quite an old-fashioned box-to-box type player, Ramsey. Yeah. He likes getting in the box late and making those runs. However, I thought the switch to 3-4-2-1 last season actually gave Ramsey a bit of a platform again. I thought he was pretty good, particularly in the FA Cup final, where of course he scored that header. And I was hoping that this season he'd start in a similar vein. Now, of course, like you said, Wenger went back to Elneny, but I think that if Arsenal are going to rediscover that kind of cutting edge to their play, they should put Ramsey back in instead of Elneny for the next few weeks.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Evan, you saw this one as well.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting. Leicester really went... They kind of went for a 4-4-2, 4-4-1-1, as you'd expect from them. Lots of attacks down the wing, Albrighton on the right, Mahrez on the left, swinging crosses in. Do you think that this was just... because Craig Shakespeare had identified a perceived weakness in Arsenal, and you know a couple of goals did come down the flanks? Or do you think this is just how Leicester are going to play this season? They're going to be one of those really kind of traditional throwback teams who are going to bombard down those wings?
Yeah, I don't think it was a huge change from traditional sort of Leicester that we saw 2 seasons ago. They kind of, you know, always played with Albrighton and Mahrez down the wings. I think, yeah, as you sort of alluded to there, that Arsenal playing this kind of back three, there's not much width in defence. particularly with like Oxlade-Chamberlain playing left wing back. It's kind of a, I don't think, you know, it's not his natural position. He does look quite out of place there. So I think they had a lot of joy down that side. But yeah, I'm not sure. I think Arsenal had a bit of a makeshift defence in there. Had Kolasinac, Monreal, Holding.
Yeah, Mustafi was on the bench.
Yeah, I think he's coming back from injury, is he?
Yes.
So I'm not sure if it was a deliberate sort of knee tactic from Shakespeare. I think that is how they're going to play against most teams. And I think they should once again. They're going to be dangerous this year. I think that, you know, they can.
They do look like they've got something. I think they will escape the relegation battle. I think they're going to be more of a mid-table side this year. Little update on Arsenal. We've got Lucas Perez trying to wangle his way out of the club still. Deportivo La Coruña are increasingly confident they're going to get him, as far as I'm aware, but still slightly short of what Arsenal want financially. But it was a crucial win in the end for Arsenal, who were top on Friday night. But the league leaders at the end of the weekend are Manchester United. They romped to a victory over a fairly pitiful West Ham side. They were 4-0 victors, Luke Brown. And what did you make of the new league leaders, Manchester United?
I think it was arguably the greatest Mourinho performance at United. They looked so, so good. Nemanja Matic performed in exactly the way that we all thought he would. He was just absolutely tremendous in the middle, and he freed up Paul Pogba to actually kind of get forward a lot more, which is what United fans were hoping to see. I think possibly most exciting from a United perspective was the way as well that Rashford and Lukaku linked up, because it looked like they'd been playing together for years, and the way that Rashford cut inside and kind of played in the pass, which led to Lukaku's first goal, was absolutely brilliant. And also just the strength and depth that United have. We've seen this week Anthony Martial being linked to Tottenham, for example. Yep. The fact that they can bring somebody like him, you know, on from off the bench, come straight on, scores a goal. They just look like they've got one of the strongest squads. Lindelof didn't even play, obviously.
Didn't even get in the squad, right?
No.
Jose said that's to do with he thinks he needs more time to adapt to England.
Yeah, and he wasn't brilliant in the Super Cup, was he? He had some problems. But, I mean, yeah, just the strength and depth is tremendous.
Let's remember, though, Jack, David Moyes, I believe, won his first Premier League game in charge of United, a thumping 4-1 win at Swansea. So, one, should we hold off putting too much stock in this opening day victory? And two, is this more symbolic than anything, just because of their struggles at home last season where they were drawing way too many games? This is so convincing, the way they came about and get this result.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, last year they drew at home with Stoke, Burnley, West Ham, Hull, Bournemouth, West Brom and Swansea. Those are all games you'd expect them to win. And, you know, with those points, they would have been much, much nearer the title race. And I think that all United really need to do this season is to show that they can start turning those draws into wins by playing like this. So in that sense, it was the perfect response.
So you think... I wasn't convinced they were title contenders coming into the season. It's a good start, obviously. They've got a strong squad. We've seen Chelsea drop points already. There are some other results which we'll get onto later. But United might have the right makeup for a Premier League winning squad rather than, say, like a Champions League winning squad this season.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if you look at the first hour of the Super Cup when they could barely get a touch of the ball,
yeah.
I mean, that shows how far away they are in Europe. Certainly against the very, very best teams. But, I mean, ultimately, you don't need to be that good to win the Premier League.
Well, you just need to be quite consistent.
Yeah, you need to be a bit of... You need to have a clear idea of how you want to win, which they do. You need to have a bit of luck with injuries or to not be in Europe, but I think they probably have a big enough squad to ride that out. You need your other... You need your rivals to fail. But ultimately, I think it's very plausible that United could, without playing especially well, end up winning the title this year, particularly if City don't manage to turn it on.
And in Lukaku, they've added an elite goal scorer. I think Luke's point is wise, that they've been trying to get Rashford and Lukaku in the same team with good reason. And it does look good. Evan, do you have any other thoughts on United West Ham?
The other thing I was going to say about United, they've got quite a nice start to the season. They've got quite a few easy games, which could really build some momentum for them. You know, if they can go 5-6 games, win them all.
It also means they can rotate in the Champions League this autumn as well. Yeah, like, exactly, if you just get that good start, Chelsea, for example, will be on the back foot in the Premier League and also in Europe, which is, it's more of a psychological thing, but if it starts to affect team selection and these things, then yeah, it does become an issue. Stat for you, biggest Mourinho win as Man United manager. It's the biggest home win for him in the Premier League since Chelsea's 6-0 evisceration of Arsenal in March 2014. Anyone have any thoughts on West Ham? Bilic didn't have the best campaign last year. So if they're as bad as that again, do we think he could be in trouble?
I'm amazed that Bilic is still manager there. I thought they were terrible last year.
But he had the good season before in the bank.
He did. And I think that's ultimately what saved him. And I know there were extenuating circumstances, not least moving stadium and losing Dimitri Payet. But they're a complete mess, West Ham. Like, they're no organisation at all. I think that Bilic is a great guy. He's great to talk to. He's very interesting, very smart. But ultimately, I think his management is more based around motivation than it is around organisation. And I don't think in the Premier League in 2017, you can afford to be as badly organised as West Ham are. Like, even the bad teams have got managers who drill them very well, and they are, you can see what they're trying to do on the pitch. Whereas West Ham actually stand out to me in the Premier League as a team who go onto the pitch without any real plan.
And I said this last week, I think that's kind of reflected in their transfer policy as well. Although they could be about to sign someone who's quite impressive. We've got a listener question from the iTunes review section, Lee the Hammer, who asks how good a signing William Carvalho might be for them. And you think the answer is very good.
Yeah, I mean, Carvalho is a player that the top teams, not least Arsenal and Manchester City, have looked at a lot. He's for those who haven't seen him, he's a big, imposing defensive midfielder. Plays for Sporting in Portugal. He would cost a huge amount of money. I think he probably costs the best part of.
They're talking about 35 million euros. I think
35 million euros is what he'd want. But he looks well set for the Premier League. He was in the Portugal team, which won the Euros last year. He's a very good passer. He's not just a destroyer. He kind of gets moves going. He's got a good shot on him. And I think he would be well cut out for the Premier League. However, I mean, as it happens, I think that West Ham's problems are more to do with the manager than with the players. But I do think he's a good player and I do think he'd improve them.
So Carvalho, potentially a very good signing. Hope that answers your question, Lee. If you do want to obviously ask your own listener questions, please go onto iTunes and review the show. Leave your questions in there and we will be answering them every single week. That win puts United top, which means we've talked about all the teams in the top four now, I think, except for one. Tottenham Hotspur, who leapfrogged their North London rivals Arsenal by beating Newcastle 2-0 on Sunday. Luke, Spurs were good, but it seemed pretty even until Jonjo Shelvey's red card really handed Tottenham momentum in that one.
Yeah, and just what an absolutely stupid thing to do. It was a moment of absolute madness from Shelby. It did turn the game because until then, Spurs were pretty frustrated. Newcastle were defending deep. I mean, Newcastle weren't trying to play.
They were playing the better football, though, Spurs, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. And Newcastle weren't trying to play at all. And I think when you go out for 90 minutes with the intention of just making it difficult for the opposition and not offering that much on the counter, chances are you're going to lose, especially in the Premier League. Eriksen said after the game, the Spurs players were a little bit almost confused by Newcastle's approach, because usually in the Premier League it's like a basketball game and it's end to end, and in this game Spurs were being made to wait for long periods. But I think it was another performance as well. Like I think Spurs are getting a bit of a hard press in terms of not having signed anyone. Obviously, ideally they would go out and sign 2-3 more players, but there was about 4 first team players were missing for Spurs. Trippier, Danny Rose, Wanyama was on the bench. And yet they still managed to kind of get a result. Walker Peters came in and was fantastic.
I thought the kid was excellent. He got a lot of the ball, which is also always good when you're a young guy like that. But it meant he had confidence. Was very impressed by Walker Peters, actually.
And he offered something so different to Trippier.
There
was a stat, like Trippier attempted something like one dribble or something minuscule.
I think it was one completed take on.
Yeah.
In the whole of last season, he beat that in one game.
Yeah, exactly. And Walker Peters, like every time he got the ball, he was looking to actually like take on his man. And when he had Atsu running at him, I thought he kind of stood up to that threat really, really well.
No, I thought Spurs were very good, and they were patient as well, in a very frustrating game. While you're talking about transfers, Jack, Spurs are expected to do a lot of their business late on in this window. What are we expecting Levy to get done? It sounds like Davinson Sanchez of Ajax is one that they're definitely working on. They might not get it done because there are other clubs interested. Not least last January, Barcelona were very, very close to signing him and pulled out at the last minute. So what do we think? Martial, Balde Keita, Davinson Sanchez?
Well, I think the issue they have with Sanchez is that Ajax might just say no this time on the basis that they could sell him for twice as much as Spurs are offering.
They've offered him a new contract on double the wages
in 12 months' time to Real or Barca, if they think he is that good. And certainly people who know a lot about Sanchez say that they think he is going to be that good. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the interesting thing about Sanchez is that I'm not sure that is where Spurs should necessarily be prioritising their money. Like they have, they have the two best centre backs in the country. They have Dyer is a very good deputy. I think they should really be looking in forward areas and wide areas, which is why they're looking at Keita Balde, who you probably know more about than me, but I think would probably be a good signing for them.
Yeah, he's a talented kid. He came through Barcelona, went to Serie A to try and get some first team football, which is a bit like Mauro Icardi did, you know. So these are guys who've got great technical background, and then he's gone there and he's impressed for Lazio. I think he's definitely leaving this summer. He absolutely wants out, but Lazio want a fair fee for him. He seems like a player who could do it in the Premier League for me, but they're obviously keeping their options open. We know they're interested in Martial. They say there was no bid to Manchester United. And, you know, they've looked at Zaha. They've looked at Mahrez. Barkley's one they're interested in. So I'll be interested to see what Spurs do before the end.
Seems interesting that they're kind of going for those kind of number 10
sort of
forward players, but not sent out and out.
They get a lot of width from their fullbacks.
Yeah, but it seems strange that, say, Harry Kane gets injured for 6 months or 3 months. You know, we saw it, he got injured a couple of times last season, and, you know, Vincent Janssen is the backup kind of thing. They're really going to struggle if someone like Kane gets injured.
I mean, it seems like we said this exactly 12 months ago, and they haven't done anything about it, really. I don't want to ignore Newcastle. I think their performance was decent. They showed a little bit in attack with Atsu and Dwight Gayle. You can see why Rafa thinks they still need some additions and has been very vocal about it. But also Jonjo Shelvey, I can't ignore him. You know more about him than most.
Yeah, I've been watching him play since he was about 16 years old, and unfortunately he probably hasn't really matured much beyond that point. He's full of potential. I think he's such a talented player.
But potential, I mean, how old is he now?
Well, not potential, you know. Yeah,
he's mid-20s,
probably,
right?
Yeah, 25, I guess.
He's got the same
amount
of potential as me.
Yeah. He's got the talent, but it's kind of
absolutely
just masked by this idiocy. 5 yards away from the referee, stamps on Dele Alli.
You actually see, you know, there was a great view on Sky where you could see the referee roll his eyes as Shelvey does it.
Yeah.
Like, that is the level of lunacy that he was. What on earth are you doing? I'm going to have to send you off for that.
Yeah.
That is ultimate stupidity. He might lose the captaincy now over that as well, they're saying.
I mean, what must you think if you're Rafa Benitez? You know, he's not club captain, is I think Jerome Lascelles.
Yeah, he was team captain
on the day. But, you know, you give the guy the responsibility, he comes on and kind of lets you down. So, I don't know.
Yeah, what more can you say about that?
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I guess one of the biggest stories of the weekend, moving on to the next game, was Wayne Rooney's goal-scoring return to Everton in their win over Stoke. I actually thought they weren't at their best, but Jordan Pickford had a great game, a £30 million man. I suppose it's good for him to get a good start because he's so young. That fee really could weigh on him, but he was excellent. They have a surprising amount of depth as well, if you look at that squad. But Mark Hughes said post-match today is all about him. So what do we expect from Rooney and Everton now?
Well, it's interesting to see how Rooney's going to develop at Everton this season, particularly with the new players they bring in. Like, I think we probably all expect him to play as a second striker or number 10 this year. But of course, if they get Gylfi Sigurdsson for £50 million, he would want to play there. And all of a sudden, they've got a slight issue between Sigurdsson and Rooney. So I genuinely don't know how that's going to resolve itself. I mean, it might be that Rooney's best role is to try and reinvent himself as a kind of poacher, like a sort of Jermaine Defoe type player, which of course is something that he's failed to do in the past. But if he could do that and continue to score goals like the one he scored on the weekend, I think we might well, but maybe even see an England return.
From what I saw, I think he was using his intelligence more like he did in that FA Cup final against Crystal Palace, where he drops deep and sprays the passes, and he did look good. What some of his teammates said to Simon Hughes, our man on Merseyside in the mix zone, he's one or two steps ahead of everyone else. We feel far more confident with him around. So it's almost like he is the experience and the intelligence, which is something that can't be taught. And he's got all of like 10 years plus of big, big game experience. He's got all the talent in the world. He's got the brain. He might not have the legs necessarily, Evan, but it looks like he could be an asset for them, where there were certain people who I won't name, Miguel, who were worried about what he could actually bring to Everton this year.
Yeah, actually, I saw some comments from Rio Ferdinand talking about his sort of signings of the season. He picked Rooney, obviously he's an old teammate and played with him for England, but he picked him out as one of his signings of the season. Just the all that experience that Rooney's got, you know, since he left Everton, went to Manchester United, he's won everything. Absolutely. Now he's going back, just having a player of his sort of stature around the training pitch in the dressing room. You know, you saw him like linking up with Calvert-Lewin, young English striker, and you know the influence he's going to have on players like that. I think could be really good for Everton, even if he doesn't add loads of goals. I think just his presence in, you know,
yeah, I think he'll set up a lot as well, even if he doesn't score them. Yeah. He set a new Premier League record for the longest gap between two appearances for the same team, 4,837 days. We should probably say something about Stoke, Luke. Newsflash from there, Hesse, the former Real Madrid youngster, now at Paris Saint-Germain, is about to sign on loan for a season. He'll buttress their attack, I guess. They had a bad end to last season. They've lost their first game, albeit not by a lot, but it's not the best start for Mark Hughes. He's going with this 3-4-2-1 shape as well, that very trendy 3-4-2-1 now in the Premier League. So what do we think of Stoke?
I think they just desperately need some flair players, don't they, really? I know that Arnautovic, they obviously got a fairly good price for him.
You got a very good price for him.
But the problem is that, you know, although he's quite an enigmatic player and although he kind of picks and chooses the games he's going to turn up and really put in a good performance, he would still put in incredible performances for Stoke and win Stoke games. So the fact that they've sold him for a lot of money, if they then don't go out and reinvest that money in similar players who are going to turn games around, then, you know, what's the point, really?
They actually remind me a lot of West Ham, who we were just talking about. Like, no real organisation, no real plan, reliant on exciting players. And I think that, you know, basically a type of play which I think is increasingly outmoded in the Premier League. And I wouldn't be at all surprised to see them, even if Hesse comes and even if Hesse does well, to see them towards the bottom end of the league over the course of the season.
I like Hesse. I think he's a very talented kid, but he couldn't turn it on. Going back to his hometown club last year on loan with Las Palmas, I think his attitude isn't quite right. He'll be with a few Spanish guys up in Stoke, but if this doesn't work out for him, then he's going to plummet through the league, because I think it's kind of it. But I don't think it's the best place to be if you want to succeed. What I will say in Stoke's defence, which is rare that I'm going to defend them, but their back three of Martins, Indy, Shawcross, and Kurt Zouma is not a bad back three. I think that's three very good, good to very good Premier League centre-backs, Evan.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. The strange thing about Stoke, I think, as you were saying, but with West Ham, they seem to have lost their identity a bit, don't they, the last few years? You know,
first it was a deliberate thing, and now it seems like a genuine loss to the club.
Yeah, I think it's fine if you change your identity for another one, but it just seems that they've lost their old kind of...
They got rid of one and maybe
one
haven't brought in
just
anything
haven't
new.
Brought in another one, yeah. So...
We should move on to some more Premier League new boys. Brighton, they're the final promoted side that we haven't discussed yet, guys. They lost 2-0 to Manchester City. I guess that's a respectable defeat at home to the title favourites. First of all, can I get your thoughts on Albion, please? Evan, you watched this one.
Yeah, I saw bits of it. I thought they did quite well, actually. You know, they kept probably the best attacking team in the Premier League. Man City have got talents all over the pitch. They kept them quiet for, I think it was 70 minutes, was it, the first goal?
Yeah, the first goal was 70, and then 75th minute own goal from Lewis Dunk.
Yeah, they looked very well organised.
It was Chris
football.
Hughton.
Yeah, exactly.
They played, I felt, with the nous that you'd expect from someone like Chris Hughton, who's an experienced manager, who knew that they were going to be up against it.
Yeah.
I enjoyed Lewis Dunk's header because it was a brilliant finish. It was one of those own goals where he's genuinely thumped it past his own keeper. Dunk is never dull. He's the seventh player to score an own goal in his Premier League debut, and that's kind of fitting because he is partial to a calamity, be it a red card or an own goal. So if you've not seen much of him before, he's one to keep an eye on this season. I think Brighton, we didn't get to see the best of them. They've got some good players there who we will see far more of when they have chances to attack, basically. But they're up against an impressive City side. Jack, City were playing a new shape. They had Aguero and Gabriel Jesus up front, so it was kind of a 5-2-1-2 sort of shape.
Yeah, well, that's how they've been playing in pre-season, this 3-5-2. And I think you're right. I think that Pep's doing it because he wants to play Aguero and Gabriel together as a pair. And I think he wants to do that because I don't think he really trusts Aguero to do the pressing that he wants. Right. I mean, we all know there's this issue between Guardiola and Aguero. I think this largely stems from the defensive work that Aguero doesn't do. I think that, you know, if it were it not for Gabriel's broken foot in February last season, I think Gabriel would have played far more and Aguero would have played far less over the second course of the second half of last season. I actually think that Guardiola in part blamed Aguero for City's defeat at Monaco away, which got them knocked out of the Champions League. But Aguero's still there. He's the main man. The board love him. The fans love him. And I think to kind of solve this issue, he's played the two together. However, I don't think that the 3-5-2 is really sustainable as City's best formation because their best player in the second half of last season was Leroy Sané. Right, and the only place that Sané can play in this system is left wing-back, which he has done a little bit in pre-season, but it's not really where you want him. So I wonder if over the course of the season we'll see City perhaps moving back to the 4-3-3 to get Sané back in the team, potentially at the cost of Aguero.
And when they're rotating for the Champions League, it'll make more sense. You know, they'll only need to play one of them. I guess you could, if add a push, put Jesus out wide in the 4-3-3 as well. But broadly, we're all impressed by City. All think City are still favourites. I mean, they've got a lot to show, I think, on the field this season. They've got an incredibly deep bench, as you said earlier. And when you compared that to their title challenges, it was obvious. But, Luke, is there a sense that City still may be a defender short?
Yeah, it will be really, really interesting to see City in their first game against the kind of team that's really going to go at them. Obviously, Brighton's only real choice in that match was to sit back, to try and contain City. Kyle Walker was obviously man of the match and just spent pretty much the entire game in Brighton's half. So when a team actually kind of tries to get beyond the fullbacks and actually kind of put pressure on that defence, I think that's when we'll get a true kind of gauge of City's title credentials. I mean, as Jack said, they're not going to be able to play that formation, I don't think, in every single match.
They'll be much better when Mendy's back, though, because Danilo is not on that wing back.
Danilo struggled.
I don't know why they're thinking he can play both sides, because no evidence at Real Madrid suggests he's even that good, let alone good enough to play left wing back.
And just the fact that, a player like Sané can be restricted to, A, the substitutes bench, and then he comes on in a kind of unfamiliar position, I mean, their strength and depth is ridiculous, but I do think that there's still some work for Guardiola to do in working out how to kind of accommodate all of his best players.
The one worry I have with City is that they've spent more than £200 million this summer, and then they're still in the position they've been in for years, which is this desperate dependence on Vincent Kompany. The evidence of last season is that when Kompany isn't fit, City are a complete shambles at the back. When he is fit, they're really good. And yet, you know, the solution to that is surely going to be buy an experienced centre-back who means that, you know, you can survive the loss of Kompany. They haven't done that, and now, obviously, Kompany's fit, City are fine. If Kompany gets injured again, City are in trouble.
And there's no evidence you can rely on him to stay fit either.
Yeah.
No.
And do we think Pep knows who his favoured partner is at the back for Kompany? He played three at the back on Sunday.
With the three, I think it's Stones in the middle and Kompany and Otamendi either side. If it's going to be the two, I imagine it'd be Stones because Pep loves Stones' ability to play out from the back.
Yeah.
But you know, Stones is such a good example because Stones is so good when Kompany's there to hold his hand and tell him what to do. Take Kompany out and have Otamendi alongside Stones and the two of them are completely clueless.
We're nearly through the weekend's action. We managed to get this far somehow without discussing the Goldfest at Vicarage Road on Saturday. Luke, you were there. You watched Watford 3, Liverpool 3. What's the biggest thing you took away from that game?
It was an absolutely bizarre match. I think everybody knew it was going to be a bizarre match when Okaka started and was absolutely sensational for 20 minutes, scored the opening goal. Liverpool are just so bad at the back. All three goals were a result of defensive errors. There was a suggestion of offside for the third, so Klopp's post-match comments kind of centred around that. But they've just got so much work to do. Marino was just not... They had a poor game. Alexander-Arnold, obviously, is young, but again, he struggled.
We've got a listener question from Whitefang at LA on iTunes. I said if you leave a review with your question in there, we will get it on the pod. And he asks if injuries are Liverpool's biggest barrier to a title challenge, but it does seem like their defence is.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. It's the back line. They desperately need some kind of reinforcements there. Klopp's post-match comments were very strange, actually, because he gave an interview in which he said that the club were working on making new signings, especially defensive signings, but then almost kind of rode back on those comments and said, you know, that maybe going out and signing a player wouldn't necessarily be the kind of, you know, magic solution to Liverpool's defence, which is what Carragher alluded to.
But that's true, right?
Is there an argument to be made that the biggest improvement to Liverpool's defence could be on the training field.
Like, you'd hope Andrew Robertson could be an upgrade on Moreno because he's been inconsistent, to say the least, since he's been there. You'd hope Virgil van Dijk, if that finally happens, would help the situation out. But considering they are looking this bad all the time, and especially from set-piece situations which are eminently fixable, can we not start looking at the coaching rather than just the personnel?
I think you can. And the van Dijk situation just reminds me of when Liverpool went out and bought Lovren. Just because, you know, it's a defender coming in for big money from a Premier League rival who's got Premier League experience, who's then just expected to completely transform the defence. But the problems with Liverpool's defence have been there a pretty long time. You know, it's a long time since they've had a title winning worthy defence. And I really don't think signing Van Dijk will suddenly make all of his teammates, you know, defend properly from set pieces. The corners they conceded goals from, it was just basic stuff. Akaka is a pretty big bloke, and he was standing completely unmarked from an in-swinging corner. So transfers aren't going to solve that.
Yeah, and they had, you know, playing this sort of zonal marking, aren't they, at corners in Liverpool. But they had, like, Roberto Firmino as the guy in the middle.
Yeah, zonal marking can work, but you need to do it right.
Yeah.
We do have some latest news, which is that Philippe Coutinho not travelling to Germany for their Champions League tie against Hoffenheim. We've got a listener question from Twitter, which Ricardo at Boy Without a Thorn. If Liverpool sell Coutinho, who realistically could they replace him with at this point in the transfer market, Jack?
Well, it's difficult because, you know, they won't be able to replace him with anyone as good. Like, that's the problem with this kind of player. One guy who we discussed earlier off air, I think, could do a good job is Julian Draxler. Made a surprise.
Could be available.
I don't know if I've stolen your suggestion there, but he obviously went from Wolfsburg to Paris Saint-Germain last year. Since when Paris Saint-Germain have signed a left winger called Neymar.
Yeah, no, I've heard he's good.
Apparently he's quite handy, and he plays in Draxler's position. So that makes you think, well, Draxler, like Javier Pastore, you know, he won't be getting a game for a while.
PSG have got an abundance of great young attackers. They've also got Giovanni Lo Celso. They signed from Rosario Central about a year ago, and that kid is the nuts.
Yeah.
So I think at least one of those has to give. There are too many guys there. Lucas Moura is still there.
Yeah.
There are a lot of players in those roles who could go. Draxler is a very talented player. He's the sort of player that Premier League clubs are all desperate to sign. So I think that is a pretty good suggestion. Luke, do you have anyone?
Again, it's very difficult. Lanzini?
Well, they've been linked with Lanzini, but he's personally, I mean, I don't think he's anywhere near good enough. Do you think so?
I think he's a good player, and I think he's done well in a team that, you know, has struggled. I mean, last year, West Ham were pretty abject. He had that game against Tottenham that Jack and I were at, and he was absolutely incredible. The problem that Liverpool are going to have is that if they suddenly receive 90 million, 100 million, 100, you know, whatever, teams are going to demand a significant portion of that for their star attacking player, as Lanzini is at West Ham. So they're going to be paying over the odds for whoever they get. So maybe aiming for realistic targets isn't the way to go. Maybe they should just kind of, you know, target some pretty out there signings.
Evan, who would the out there signing be?
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I suppose there are kind of obvious Premier League options, like maybe Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain or Riyad Mahrez. But yeah, more out there ones, maybe Klopp might look back to the Bundesliga.
Try Pulisic again? Someone.
Pulisic, maybe. Maybe Emil Forsberg
At Leipzig.
At Leipzig. Or even like a Max Meyer at Schalke. He's kind of a, you know, quite young. He's not a finished product.
Loves the club, though.
I wonder if Klopp might have a look back for Mario Götze. It was obviously good for Klopp and Dortmund before his move to Bayern.
The kid who completed football at 22 and has kind of gone off the radar.
His career's obviously
gone
pretty much off the rails. He's now back at Dortmund. But, you know, Klopp knows him better than anyone. He's got him to play so well. He could actually do that role there.
Yeah, I mean, to answer your question, Ricardo, we don't really know, but it does look like Coutinho might be staying put regardless. It'll be interesting to see if Klopp can get him back into the fold at the end of the day.
Can I really quickly as well just say something about Watford?
Because
Watford were very good, was really impressed. Obviously, they've got their own issues. They conceded three goals. Gomez was typically a little bit dodgy. But what we were saying about De Boer going into Crystal Palace and trying to implement this philosophy really, really quickly, I think Silva deserves credit for delivering quite a kind of un-Silva performance. I expected to see this kind of new flowing style and possession-based football. He selected Okaka up front, used him as a complete battering ram, pushed cleverly up front, and it was quite a kind of pragmatic counter-attacking
He's a smart coach. He can be very hard-nosed as well. I think that's one of his great things. He's versatile. He gets the players playing for him. I thought they looked good as well.
He's brave as well to leave Andre Gray out after signing him for, you know, a club record fee, I think.
Yeah, I like what Marco Silva's doing. I think Watford will be good.
The only slight cause for concern, I thought, is they looked absolutely brilliant in the first half, and then they just had a 15 minutes of kind of collapse in the second half. I think that
thrilling.
Yeah, it was great fun for everyone.
From that thriller in Hertfordshire, we go to the final two games, which managed just a single goal between them, so we won't spend too long on those. West Brom beat Bournemouth thanks to a goal from new signing 6'5" centre-half Ahmed Hegazi, who I would bet every penny I own will now become known as Big Ahmed by Tony Pulis if he is not already. The Baggies looked like everything we expect from a Pulis side, Jack. They were solid, they were tough to break down, they were strong from set pieces, and of course Bournemouth struggled to break them down.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we all expect Pulis to get the same result this season that he gets every season. I think the evidence of, for example, Pulis' time at Stoke is that eventually fans get bored and don't want it anymore. I don't know whether we're at that point yet with West Brom fans. You'd have to ask them. But for now, no one knows better than Pulis how to get the most of the resources that he's got.
Absolutely. Afobe and King up front for Bournemouth. Defoe came on for the last 35 minutes or so. Luke, Evan, do we worry about the front line being able to break teams down, and particularly away from home?
Potentially, yeah. And I mean, when we did our predictions last week, which we talked about on the pod, I selected that Defoe was going to be the flop of the season. I don't think he's going to be able to replicate the two performances he had for Sunderland in the last two seasons. It's really hard to see him getting to 15 goals. And I think Bournemouth could struggle this year.
Yeah, I think they had something like 70% possession, didn't they, against, you know, Pulis's West Brom, who traditionally don't have very much possession. But they created one chance.
West Brom did not look like conceding in this game.
So I think that's a worrying sign if you're a Bournemouth fan.
And actually, a more exciting game was goalless on the south coast in Southampton for Swansea's visit. It was a game very much dominated by Saints, who should have won this, absolutely should have won this. And Paul Clement was under no illusions that his side had been outplayed. They escaped with a point, which bodes well for them, Jack. But Pellegrino's side, they might not be very attacking, but I think they could be very effective.
Yeah, they could well be. I worry a bit for Swansea, actually, this season. I think that the evidence the last 2 years suggests that giving a permanent job to a manager who kept you up isn't always the best way of keeping you up the following year. I look at Sunderland, the number of managers who kept them up who they then had to get rid of because they couldn't reproduce it the next season. I know Clement did really well last year, but they looks like they're going to lose Sigurdsson. They haven't bought well for a while at Swansea, and so I expect them to be in trouble in a few months' time.
I think like Sigurdsson was responsible for 20 goals, was it, last season for a club that nearly got relegated. That's a big chunk, isn't it? And you know, even if they do get £50 million, they haven't got long to replace him, have they? So
well, they just got to find a guy who's good at set pieces because so many of those goals came from set piece situations or assists as well. But that is all 10 games from the weekend that we've covered. I do want to have a quick look ahead. On Tuesday, Liverpool against Hoffenheim in the Champions League. It's very important for them. It's a very tough playoff round where you've got a lot of these good teams that finished fourth in their big leagues playing against each other while the champions from smaller leagues play against each other. I completely understand why they do that, and I think it's good. But it means that, unfortunately, we're going to lose either Liverpool or Hoffenheim at this stage. Do you have any thoughts going into this one, Evan?
Yeah, I think, I mean, Liverpool really need to pull out a big performance after the weekend, kind of a disappointing 3-3 draw. It'll be a disaster, really, if they don't qualify for the Champions League. But it's by no means going to be an easy tie against Hoffenheim. I think if they can nick a 1-0 or, you know, one goal lead, they're away tomorrow night, aren't they? And then get them back to Anfield, then I think that'll be okay. But if they're a goal behind or maybe going in level, then it's going to be a nervy fixture.
But it could suit them to play on the counter attack. Away at Hoffenheim, Luke, whereas obviously against Watford they were more dominant than they would be.
Yeah, although as we said, their problems came from set pieces. So, you know, if Hoffenheim get that opportunity, I think you would back them to maybe take some chances. Worryingly for Liverpool as well, Hoffenheim are very good at home and have a very good defensive record. So, it looks like it could be a very tricky game for Liverpool. And I think Liverpool's strategy against Watford was just to outscore them. In a Champions League tie where, you know, away goals come into the equation, and with the fact that Hoffenheim are traditionally good at home, that Klopp won't be able to kind of use that strategy, which could kind of really, really hurt them.
It's huge for Liverpool, absolutely massive. Celtic also in Champions League action, I believe. And we've got Everton on Thursday. But next week's Premier League slate, Swansea Man United is the Saturday lunchtime game. Got the 3 p.m. slate is interesting. Bournemouth versus Watford, Burnley versus West Brom, Leicester versus Brighton, Liverpool v Palace is probably the pick of them, with De Boer going to Anfield needing a result, and maybe Liverpool with one eye on the Champions League. Southampton against West Ham. The 5:30 game should be interesting. I think Arsenal visiting Stoke, an early kind of televised national viewing under the microscope for Mark Hughes, who really got away with it down the stretch last season because people weren't paying attention to how bad their results were. But then on Sunday, Huddersfield versus Newcastle should be interesting, I think, a clash of newly promoted sides. And then the big one, as you say, at Wembley, Jack, not a cup final, but feels like an early, well, certainly the most important game of the early season. We've got a listener question from at Ready Harish 123, a listener from Bengaluru in India. Thank you. We appreciate our international listeners. Do Chelsea have any chance of getting anything at Spurs next week? If they lose, they'll already be 6 points off the pace.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's going to be fascinating to see whether Chelsea get out of that. I mean, of course, the last time the two teams met, I think, was the FA Cup semi-final at Wembley, where Chelsea were just too strong for a Tottenham team playing well. Chelsea were just too strong and beat them. But
do you remember Tottenham went into that and everyone was saying Tottenham are the form team. Tottenham could do this. Tottenham could overturn Chelsea. And Chelsea and Conte really just put on a clinic that day.
Yeah, yeah, they were really good. But then equally, like I can think of two times in the last few seasons where Pochettino's Tottenham have kind of unpicked Chelsea and really, really exposed them. There was the 5-3 in January 2015 at White Hart Lane. And then, all not quite as exciting, but even more impressive than that, when Tottenham ended Chelsea's famous winning run in January of this year, beat them 2-0 at home. And, you know, so clearly they've got an ability against both, I mean, first against Mourinho's Chelsea and also against Conte's Chelsea. Tottenham know how to beat them. Like, they can match them for organisation, for physical strength, for power, for incision. And so they've got all the tools to do it. And given that Chelsea will be coming into this game off the back of the terrible Burnley defeat with suspended Gary Cahill and Cesc Fabregas. Yeah. Like, there's never been a better time for Tottenham to assert themselves over Chelsea again and to show that they can start winning big Premier League games routinely at Wembley, which is going to be one of the big, big question marks hanging over them this season.
If they do beat Chelsea, obviously it's a big thing because it continues the momentum really from the last two campaigns. Whereas if they got off to a poor start, people are asking questions. There's this slight, how would you say, tumult about the contract and players not being paid enough. Danny Rose, since we last recorded, apologised for that. Not quite. He apologised for the timing and manner of his comments, but not necessarily the content. What do you read into that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, clearly he stands by the opinions that he expressed.
He wants to get paid more.
Even though he regrets the, you know, the kind of clunkiness of them appearing in another newspaper a few days before the start of the season. I think that's a recognition of the fact that lots of Spurs players agreed with what Danny said. Like, that is a squad full of players who feels underpaid because, you know, they came second last year, they came third the year before, they were established as one of the best teams in the country, and yet they're paid like they're still the sixth best team in the country.
And indeed, Hugo Lloris came out and said yesterday that he completely understood the comments.
Yeah, that is Rose's frustration. And Spurs, you know, people shouldn't think that the other players don't feel that way just because they haven't come out and said it. You know, the other players might think, well, maybe it wouldn't be wise to come and say this, but they all feel that way. And I think ultimately, if Tottenham are really going to keep this exciting group of players together into the new stadium, which has always been the plan, then I think they will have to give a little bit on their wage structure, because I don't think that the current players can be kept happy on the restricted wages that they're on.
I can have a quick prediction for this one then, Jack.
Tottenham are going to win 2-0.
Luke?
I'm going to go 2-1 Tottenham.
2-1 Tottenham.
1-1 draw.
Yeah, I weirdly fancy Chelsea. I know they haven't actually necessarily done that well at Wembley even recently, but I really, really think Conte knows how to fire a team up. I think they're going to be back in for this. I wouldn't even be surprised if they signed a player this week because they seem to realise now they need to get on that. Danny Drinkwater, Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, two guys they're looking at a lot. But I think otherwise, that's pretty much it for the week, guys. So thank you for joining us for this week's Indie Football Podcast. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us again. The listener numbers have been amazing so far, and we really appreciate that with so many alternatives out there. If you would like your question to be part of next week's show, as I said, the best thing you can do is get them into review on iTunes. If they're 5-star, you've got a better chance. But otherwise, after a hectic first weekend of the Premier League season, that is all we have time for. So allow me to say thank you to Peckham's finest, Jack Pitbrook.
Thank you, Ed.
Evan Bartlett, say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Luke Brown, say thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you to producer Matt Murphy and also to Acast, who help us out with the podcast every week. That is everything. Until next Monday, goodbye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.